All right, we're in CLR world again, and this time it's Threadpool. Who are you?
Hi, I'm Erica Fuentes. I'm a PM for threading.
Excellent.
And I'm Eric Albrecht. I'm a dev on CLR threading.
Cool. So let's talk about, you know, what's new in V4. CLR 4, you guys did a lot of work in the Threadpool. What are some of the key additions?
So, yeah, we have a lot of improvements done compared to what we had before. Some of the main points are the queuing strategies for the Threadpool and concurrency control, better concurrency control algorithm.
Good. Which isn't, yeah.
I don't know. Do you want us to elaborate more?
Of course. Well, this is Channel 9, elaboration. And the whiteboard looks awfully white. So, yeah, please,
so
dig in.
I think we should start by saying, why are these improvements happening? So one of the reasons that we have these changes are because, well, first of all, we're moving to a world where the multi-core technology is becoming very common, and it's becoming frequent, and it's becoming like the high end. So people not only are getting new kinds of machines in their hands, but also you need new strategies to approach the problems in a world where concurrency is starting to matter. So in the past, you have a single core, and in single core, it was fairly easy to control concurrency and allocate work into different threads, thinking that you only have one core, but now you have several cores. So that introduces complexity, not only for programming, but also for synchronization techniques. The other thing is that the thread pool, as it was before, it was targeting specific kinds of applications in which the work items that were queued to the thread pool were coarse grained. So you have these very big work items where you have to do a lot of work, and synchronization and overhead incurred by other things that don't matter really that much. But now with the parallel frameworks, then you are able to split these work items into small tasks, and these small tasks, well, you have to incur into the overhead many, many times as opposed to that. So we need new strategies to address that.
Sure. Excellent. And that goes back to the work that Joe Duffy and Stephen Tube and all the geniuses over in PCP world are working on. Joe Duffy, of course, was on the Threadpool V1. So what did you do?
So, look, it comes down to, you know, like she was saying, it's kind of two sides to this. There's, you know, a thread pool is just, you know, you can think of it very simply. It's just a queue, and you put work items in a queue, and then there's some set of threads that pull the work out of the queue. And so your questions are, you know, how do you build that queue, and then how do you manage those threads? And more, the most important decision there is, how many threads should you have? And where should they be running? That we're not really addressing that for V4. And so maybe I should talk about a little bit about how the Orcus thread pool worked.
Great.
And then we can talk about how we changed from there. So in Orcus, there's a single global work queue for every app domain. And you know, when you call threadpool.queue user work item, it takes a lock on that queue, it sticks it on there, and it's just a regular linked list of objects that we allocate. There's one of those per app domain, and then down inside of the virtual machine itself, there's another component that manages the threads and creates them or destroys them on demand, and then calls into each of these app domains one by one and tells them to run the work that's in there. So we're keeping that same model in 4.0. What we're doing is, first of all, making some improvements to that queue. We're no longer going to have to take that lock. That turned out to be, for very, very small work items, that turned out to be a significant source of overhead. And it's funny because I always talk about, you know, you shouldn't do lock-free data structures, and it's, you know, you'll never get them right, and they're almost never faster anyway, right? But this is one of these cases where it actually is faster, and it's worth doing because we do all the hard work once, and, you know, hopefully it benefits everybody.
Awesome.
So, and then we're adding work stealing queues as well, and I think you've spoken with Joe about those.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The idea with work stealing is that you can eliminate even more synchronization overhead by doing processor local or thread local queues, and then doing your load balancing by having each thread steal from other threads when it runs out of work. It turns out it's a very nifty algorithm that is almost impossible to understand, you know, deep in its core, but it works out so that in many cases you don't have to do any synchronization at all.
Excellent.
And so you get rid of most of that overhead.
Cool. So let's draw some pictures. I mean, let's talk about how, you know, for I think one thing that would be interesting, it would be what is replacing the sort of the locks, or lock-free data structures. What does that look like?
So, you know, what we had before was you call queue user work item, and we would allocate a node. There's this list here. And each of these has a, you know, and we just had a straightforward queue of these, and each of these pointed off to its own work item. So you see, there's already you have to allocate.
Yeah.
Allocation in managed code is actually really, really fast, but garbage collection is the sort of the consequence for allocation, right? And every time you do a garbage collection, you have to traverse all of this. And in addition to that, you have to, you know, in this data structure, you have to take a lock on the whole thing so that you can manipulate it without, you know, losing data. In our testing, we actually found that so the locks, under certain circumstances, were a really severe problem. But the time to just traverse these things during garbage collection was actually a much more significant factor in a lot of cases. So we kind of tried to optimize both of those. And what we ended up with is something that looks much more like an array, where each of these points off to a work item. And then, you know, this is there's another array here. So we allocate the queue in these chunks. And so the manipulation of the chunks is still kind of, you know, there's synchronization overhead and things like that. But within the chunk, well, now you're just dealing with indexes. You don't have all these pointers all over everywhere, and those are hard to manipulate. Mm-hmm. Manipulating integers in a lock-free manner, you know, here you're just talking about incrementing, you know, index 0, 1, 2, so you have your current index is 0, and if you want to move to the next one, you just do an interlocked increment on this. It's a single interlocked instruction, which is about half of the overhead you would get in the ideal case with a lock. And then, because these are arrays, the GC is able to traverse these much, much faster. You know, here it has to follow these pointers, and it may go all over memory, and it may invalidate cache lines all over the place, and here, you know, it's all nice and contiguous, and it's just an array, and it knows that, and the GC just, you know, increments an index through it and does it very quickly. We also trimmed down the size of these objects a little bit.
Excellent, man.
Yeah. And then, so we have this queue, and then off to the side, we went with per-thread work-stealing queues. It's slightly more efficient to do it per processor, but it means you have to explicitly manage which threads are running on which processors, and that adds, you know, enough complication that it just seemed not to be worth it.
Right. Yeah.
So
you don't want developers actually thinking explicitly about cores, right?
Yes, you don't want the developers to have to think about it, which means that the thread pool itself, you know, has to think about it. And
yes,
that turns out to be really difficult. And, you know, there are a lot of really smart guys on the Windows team who have figured out all sorts of great algorithms for, you know, in the underlying kernel scheduler for assigning threads to cores and making sure it runs efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, well, they, you know, we'll let them do that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's actually one of the things that we want to stress regarding the threat pool. So most of this work, you don't actually get to see it in a new flashy API, but we have done a lot of work to facilitate the use for the user, for the developers. Mm-hmm. So basically, we do all the hard work under the covers so that the average developer doesn't mm-hmm. have to deal with this kind of complicated issues.
I like to think of the threat pool as you know, the GC is there to manage your memory, and the threat pool is there to manage your threads, right? And so we kind of approach it the same way that GC guys approach their problems, which is, you know, we don't want the user to ever have to think about this thing. It doesn't always work out that way, and we do have, end up having to provide some overrides for people. But we'd like people to not have to use those as much as possible.
Yeah, unfortunately, when you are trying to optimize for a general purpose application or feature, it's mm-hmm. very difficult than if you are doing some sort of targeted optimization. So we encounter a lot of problems, and there are some caveats that, well, this is not perfect for everything, but we expect that for the average problem in general, it's going to deliver better performance and better behavior in general.
As you move to many cores, right?
Yes.
So let's. I mean, a lot of people have written code that targets the thread pool that are already out there today. Let's talk about compatibility. I mean, is it going to be just completely transparent to everyone?
It's. I think the queuing changes, which is all we've really talked about so far, I think the queuing changes are likely to be pretty invisible to people. I mean, it's, you know, it's just a queue, and at the end of the day, it's just a faster queue.
Cool.
Right? Things execute in the same order they did before. They execute in a different order if once work stealing comes into play. But work stealing only comes into play if you're using the new task APIs, and you know, so existing code isn't going to notice anything there. Where people may run into problems, and frankly always do whenever we touch this, is the thread management side of things. We have a different algorithm that we're using to choose the number of threads than we've done before. There have been changes to this in the past, but nothing this extensive. So we're crossing our fingers, we're doing lots of testing, and we hope it works out. You would think that it wouldn't matter how many threads you have. Your application maybe would run slower or faster, but we have found a shocking number of cases where people actually really do care about the exact number of threads. I got a bug report a while back about the Orcus thread pool. There was a change, again, in this same algorithm between Wigbee and Orcus, and they switched to Orcus, and they found that their requests to their servers just started failing all over the place. And it turned out to be because in Wigbee, the number of threads was capped at a certain limit, and that limit was raised in Orcus. And their server could only accept, you know, it was 25 connections or something. And so with the Wigbee limits, they got that limited for them by the thread pool. And once that was raised, it just started failing. The server started rejecting requests, and so it's that kind of thing that you just wouldn't expect. We don't expect it to affect very many applications, but people do run into things. Yeah.
Interesting. So, I mean, I really, quite honestly, wasn't very aware of that. I mean, so you cap the number of threads that an application can create, or that you're going to manage for them.
Right.
I mean, okay. And you've increased that in this release?
We've changed it.
So
in previous releases, I mean, this one little detail, the limit on the number of threads the thread pool will create, has changed a lot over the years. And I don't even, you know, off the top of my head, I can't remember the history entirely, but it started out as just a fixed amount, a fairly low number, 20 or something. Mm-hmm. And then it was made per CPU. It's the same number of times the number of CPUs in, I believe, Wigbee. And then in Orcus, it was changed to 250 times the number of CPUs. We're changing it yet again. the Orcus change was made because a lot of applications, you know, say you're a web client or something, and you're sending out a bunch of requests simultaneously, and maybe each request is actually made up of several work items. It's fairly common for one work item to end up waiting for another to execute. And it's sort of a, you know, we don't recommend doing that because of this problem. But the problem is that it's, you know, you have a limit of 25 threads and you put out 50 work items and half of them wait for the other half. Well, if the half that are waiting for the other half run first, the other half will never run because all the threads are tied up waiting for those to run. Mm. So you get this sort of, it's kind of like deadlock, except it's just that we're not making more threads, right? So in Orcus, it was raised to a frankly absurdly high limit on many machines. You know, on a quad-core machine, it's 1,000, right? That's a lot.
It's unnecessary.
Yes. But it's just the maximum. This is just the most we will ever create, right? There's an algorithm running behind the scenes that's managing it, and it's nearly impossible for it to create that many threads. In 4.0, we're changing it yet again, because the feedback we got on Orcus was, you know, the higher the core count gets, the more absurd this number gets, and to the point where, you know, on an 8-core machine, 32-bit process, you've just allocated all of your virtual memory for stacks for your thread pool threads, you know, potentially, if you ever got that high. So what we decided to do in 4.0 is to base it on the amount of available virtual memory. You divide that by the stack size, divide it by 2, and say, okay, we'll only use half of it for threads. Again, this is just the limit. We'll never get that high. I've never seen anything like that. And then, so that's on 32-bit systems. On 64-bit systems, you know, if you did that calculation, you find the limit is, you know, several million threads or something. And it turns out the data structures we use to track threads can't hold numbers that big. So so it's limited to, you know, 32,000 on 64-bit systems. So it's,
that should be fine.
Yeah, I think that's probably enough for now.
For most UI-based applications.
Yes.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I'm curious. I mean, you're in V4 now. Mm-hmm. What kind of applications have you seen out there in the real world that really relies so heavily on multi-threading, right? I mean, most developers spin up a thread here or there, do some background. The typical thing is the UI thread, do calculations, get data, bind it, you know, then try to figure out how to marshal it back to the UI thread, which we've made easier in .NET for a long time now. Mm-hmm. What are people really doing that would require
many threads?
Yeah. You know, more than 3, 4, or 5, right?
Well, some of the applications that expose this necessity are the ones that you can see from the TPL, the Parallel framework. So people that are doing visualization things, they need to have a lot of threads to improve the performance of their application. But not only that, so aside from things that are embarrassingly parallel, we also have applications such as ASP.NET.
Yes.
So actually, ASP.NET is probably one of our most important partners in here, and we have done a lot of work for them to make their applications better. And another one that comes to my mind.
Let's say something about ASP.NET, because it's an interesting class of application. These sort of server application, right? Mm-hmm. And you can't really lump them all together, but in a couple of regards, they're all very similar. They're typically dealing with a large number of incoming requests, and they have limited resources on the machine, and they're trying to sort of cram all these requests onto this box and run them in some kind of fair order. And you know, you don't want, this is sort of the classic use of the thread pool. The reason it probably came into existence in the first place was that you don't want to, say, spin up a new thread for every request because you use a lot of resources. So, you know, prior to this, I worked at Hotmail, and you know, there we had servers that were routinely handling thousands and thousands of requests simultaneously, and you know, you just can't make that many threads. And even if you could, you'd get overwhelmed by context switching and lock contention, and you know, all the overhead associated with threads. So in those cases, the thread pool's job is really to sort of limit things. It's to take this sort of very naturally highly concurrent problem and kind of make it less concurrent, you know? And then the TPL-style stuff is kind of the opposite problem. You're taking something that is naturally it's just a calculation that you would normally just run on one thread and, you know, very simple. But you've got all these cores, and they're going to waste. And so instead of having this naturally very concurrent thing that you cram down on a few resources, now you're taking this one thing and spreading it out. And so it's been a challenge to kind of make one thing do both of those very well. but I think we're getting there.
Good.
And that's where the other side of the improvements, we call it the thread injection algorithm. Nobody can think of a better name. for the TPL style workloads, a lot of people think, well, you just need one thread per core, and that's perfect. You know, you get optimum performance. If you add more, then it's going to slow down because now you're doing context switching and all of this. But that's not even strictly true of TPL. It's only true of things that never ever block for any reason. Things block a shocking amount of time. I mean, every multi-threaded application has locks that it acquires, and sometimes there's contention in the thread blocks. You might touch some memory that happens to not be paged in, and so you have to wait for that to page in. And so in all those cases, having more threads can help you because now you're using that time to do something else. And the trick is guessing how many threads that should be.
Yeah.
Right. And we've been through a lot of iterations on that over the years, and we're trying another one. Previously, the approach that has been taken is, okay, we're talking about CPUs running threads here, and a thread is running on a CPU, and then it blocks, so now that CPU isn't in use anymore. We want to get another thread running on that CPU. So the goal becomes maximizing CPU usage. Prior to Orcus, that was almost literally the entire goal of the thread pool, is to just keep adding threads until the CPU is set. Now you're completely saturated. That turns out to be a problem in certain cases. Like, say you have very high lock contention. You add another thread, it's going to go spin on those locks using CPU, and you go, great, wow, I'm increasing CPU usage. I'm going to keep doing this, but really you're just wasting more and more time. Or imagine an application where CPU isn't the bottleneck, which is typical for server-style applications, where they may be more constrained on disk bandwidth or network connections to other servers, things like that. Well, adding more threads is never going to help there. It's not going to drive up CPU usage. It'll help if you actually have the available resources on the real bottleneck. Adding more threads means you're maybe making more effective usage of those resources. But we found that it's very frequent that CPU is not the interesting resource and that something else is. And the trick is we don't know what else. Because we have no idea which resources you're using. We just run user code. We don't know anything about it. So we decided 4.0 is, rather than look at some resource usage metric and try to guess it, how the application views that resource, we'll just look at throughput. Because that's really what users care about. They just want stuff to get done as fast as it can happen. And so now you have to choose a way to measure throughput. And again, we don't have a lot of visibility into what the thing's doing. All we see is when a work item is queued and when it is dequeued and when it's completed. So we consider that whole cycle to be sort of a unit of work, and our measure of throughput is how many of those we manage to do in a given amount of time. So it's really, we just measure work item completions per second, and we try to maximize that. Now, an interesting consequence of this is with resource utilization, like the CPU usage, you can get these measures from the operating system that tell you, how much CPU is being used right now. With this one, we have to kind of make that up ourselves. And so we can measure the throughput, but it's hard to see it improving. Let me give an example. So, say you have two applications running on the server, right? And say their workload, we'll call this workload. This is how much work they're trying to do, right?
Okay.
And their server applications may be running on some, shared machine. The incoming request per second is constant for some amount of time. Now, this guy decides to increase
the number of threads. I'm drawing two things here, so here's the number of threads, here's usage. So he tries to increase the number of threads to see if that might increase the throughput. Okay. It wouldn't, because the incoming resource, you know, the requests for this resource are constant over time. But at the same time, this guy's requests drop. So if that happens, you know, these guys are competing for resources on the same machine. What this guy will see is that by increasing the number of threads, he got higher throughput because he's now getting what the other guy was using. So what do you do about that, right? I mean, this happens constantly. Every time you try to measure something, you're measuring that thing at that time, but you don't know what else is happening and how that might affect your measurement. And so this is the approach that was taken in previous versions. So I said that, you know, WIDB tried to optimize CPU usage purely. In Orcus, they added some limits to that where it would also monitor throughput in a similar way to what we're doing. But it would look at things in this way, where it would add a thread, it would check CPU usage, and it would check throughput. And if the throughput seemed to go up, then it would consider that good. Mm-hmm. But it could seem to go up for all sorts of reasons. So in 4.0, we're switching it to a little bit different strategy where, you know, what you might have seen with Orcus is over time your thread count would start at, you know, the number of processors, which is our default minimum number of threads. It might start here, and then every half second or so, you'd see it go up. And it would just keep doing this until, at some point, it would level out. And it would keep doing this until it, you know, the CPU became saturated or it didn't seem to be making a difference in throughput. So and this is subject to that problem. I'm saying, like, you imagine some other process has some other change going on at this same rate, right? This could just go off into the sky. And we see that. We've seen that in practice. It's a huge source of customer feedback for us. So what we're doing instead in 4.0 is you might see it do, instead of staying constant here and then going up and then staying constant, we'll go up and down. And then we might go up. Right? And then we'll go up. And we're probing. Instead of kind of just going up, we go up and then down and then up and down. And we watch for this pattern in the throughput that we see coming out on the other side. And so it's really hard to confuse this, right? Because you not only have to have some change that's happening, you know, that causes throughput to increase when I increase the threads, but it also has to cause throughput to decrease when I decrease the thread count at exactly the right time. And it has to do that repeatedly over time and in exactly the right timing. And in fact, we randomize this so that it makes that even less likely. So what you'll see, and this is one of these things where, you know, we really want people to try out the beta and try it with some things that they think are real applications they might run on this thing, because this is one of the things that we are a little bit worried might confuse some applications, because we're actually, Orcus would almost never take a thread away. You had to have pretty much no work happening in the system for threads to actually be pulled back. We take them away constantly. I mean, we're up and down, up and down, up and down over time. And we've found that this does a much better job of actually picking the right number of threads. But it's behavior that maybe wasn't anticipated by people using the thread pool before, and we could see it causing some problems. So,
interesting.
I'd like to definitely have people focus on that and see if it, you know, see if it might give them some trouble.
Now, when you say take threads away, I mean, you're talking about availability of threads, not threads that are currently doing work.
Yes.
I mean, that would be...
You know, once we start running some user work on a thread, it's not ours anymore until they return it to us. So, you know, when we decide to take a thread away, we take away the first one that comes back to us, you know.
Cool, man.
And by take away, I don't mean destroy. We're not destroying and creating threads this fast. We're just pausing them and restarting them, right?
Excellent. So now we've talked a little bit about, you know, your partner in crime, Concurrency, which is the PCP people, the parallel computing platform team. What specifically, I mean, this clearly, all this is starting to make sense, how this will help them. But, I mean, in reality, their model is, don't think about threads explicitly. Think about tasks, right? I have a task to do. I spin it up. I throw it out of the way. It gets done. I deal with it in an asynchronous fashion, parallel fashion, concurrent fashion. So they're a level above you guys in abstraction with tasks, right? So when they create a task, it could create any number of threads. Is that fair?
So when they create a task, it is much like calling queues or work item on the sort of legacy Threadful API. It doesn't necessarily create any threads.
Cool.
It just goes on a queue. And there's this algorithm running behind the scenes that does some magic and picks a number of threads and hopes for the best, right?
Magic is good. But, you know, magic got us in trouble with the CLR because people want to know sometimes exactly what's going on, a fine-grained control.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
I think people don't... I know people sometimes want fine-grained control. Typically, having that control isn't necessarily what they really want, right? You know, we want people to not have to worry about this stuff for, you know, functional purposes, right? They should never have to think about this. But the fact is, when you're optimizing the performance of your application, it, you know, frequently becomes very important to understand what's going on behind the scenes. Maybe not so much to have control over it, but just so that you can sort of accommodate it, so you can optimize your own code to work well with it. Sort of like what we were talking about with the queuing, right? I don't know anything about all the little details of how the GC works, but I know kind of basically that it, you know, it has to traverse all these objects and things. And if I didn't know that, you know, I would never be able to, you know, come up with a queue that would work well with it. But I don't need to go change the way the GC works to make my queue fast. I just need to understand how to write code to, you know, for that mechanism.
Yeah. Or like with this, the thread injection algorithm, it's important to understand that, like Eric explained, this algorithm is not longer based only on CPU utilization. So when you're writing an application and you want to take advantage of this, don't focus on how your application is using the CPU, but also this is basically a feedback loop of how many completions of work the Threadful is accomplishing for you. And if you have certain types of workloads that are going to block, or like workloads that are prone to cause starvation or something like that, it's going to behave different. And people should be aware of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you can imagine, you know, we're measuring work item completions per second. If you have work that only completes once a minute, we're not going to get a lot of measurements, and we're not going to be able to really do much with that.
Right.
We try as hard as we can, but it's going to take us much longer to respond to that kind of work and optimize things than if things are completing really quickly.
Yeah.
And that has always been true in the thread pool, but I think it's going to be even more so now.
Interesting. Yeah. Maybe because there's going to be cases where the workload, the time it takes, will be dynamic, because they may be depending on, you know, making calls out to a network resource, or, you know, the system's bogging down almost on the verge of an out-of-memory exception or something. So your results are going to be dynamic.
Yes.
But in the real, it's going to be really interesting to see how this works out now.
It is, yes.
We
definitely
also
cool.
Want to know.
So what other things? I mean, we've covered a fair amount here, but what, you know, what else is on the laundry list of what's new in CLR v4 Threadpool?
What else is new? We have... Well, we have improved queuing. We talk about that.
Yes.
We have the scheduling, work stealing, and all that. We talk about that.
It's great stuff.
And we have the thread injection. I think this is probably
the thing that
we've been, spent the most.
It's amazing. So, I mean, let's talk a little bit about, I mean, of course, you mentioned people want to get an understanding of what's going on. So what have you done from in terms of debugging and in tools for me to help understand, like, what if I wanted to figure out how that algorithm was calculating something and where it might have gone wrong, to provide you feedback?
So we have some new ATW events.
Yeah, we have some ATW infrastructure in place so that, you know, we can see the completions as they happen, or, well, sort of an aggregate measure of them, but you can kind of get a glimpse of what's going on inside of there. And we are considering releasing some tools that we use internally to analyze this stuff so that people outside of Microsoft can use them. I can't promise that right now, but it would be very good. I hope we can do it.
And give us feedback.
Yes.
Well, there's always the handy dev labs, right?
Yeah.
Throw it up there. Someone can blog about it.
That's right. And then we also have, we don't expose this directly from the thread pool, but there's a lot of new debugging support for task. The thread pool participates in that. It's you know, the debugger needs to be able to enumerate the tasks that are in the queues, and we provide the support for that. Mm-hmm. But task provides a lot of debugging infrastructure, and it's one of the many reasons why we're sort of recommending for 4.0 that task be actually the sort of the new queue user work item, right? You know, I think people think of task as the way you do these computationally intensive calculation things, and I think it's much more than that. It's sort of you know, just the way to put things in the thread pool, and it has some really snazzy options for making things go fast. You can have child tasks that get to use work stealing queues and all that kind of stuff. But even if you don't do any of that, you get a, you know, you call queues or work item, you get back this Boolean that says whether it worked or not. And by the way, that Boolean always returns false. It's I mean true, sorry.
Useful.
Yeah. You create a task, you get an object, it's got all these methods on it. You can wait for it to complete, you can find out what exception it threw, you can, you know, there's a million things you can do with the task, and it's just a much better API. Plus, you get all this rich debugging support, and I think task is the way to go going forward.
Absolutely. So one other question would be, I mean, this is implemented as a library. I mean, it's in the BCL.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, the thread pool doesn't live inside of the CLR from a virtual machine perspective.
It's both.
Let's talk about
sure,
that.
Sure. Yeah.
It's always fun.
So we talked about the queues.
Yeah.
All of that stuff happens in managed code inside the BCL, mm-hmm. And that's done primarily just for speed. Oddly enough, people think of managed code as, you know, that's slow, but it's rarely a very accurate characterization. In this case, it helps us in a couple of ways. So one is sort of just an artifact of the way our system works. It happens to be fairly expensive to call in and out of managed code. And so if you had, you know, a purely native thread pool that was executing managed work items on it, then it would be constantly calling in to managed code, and that transition is fairly expensive. So we avoid that by kind of running everything in managed code to begin with. But the other thing we get is these queues turn out to be much easier to write in managed code and faster because we're manipulating them. We're doing lock-free operations on references when we manipulate these. I talked about the segments of the queues, and they're chained together, and we do lock-free manipulation of the references in there. There's a lot of lock-free stuff in the work-stealing queues as well. Anytime you're manipulating references or pointers, things like that, with these, you know, lock-free operations, you run into this problem called the ABA problem. The basic problem is, so you allocate an object and you store a reference to it, and then you do a compare exchange on that to swap in a new thing, right? Now somebody else does a compare exchange using what they read out of it before you did that. So I should write this down because it's all right. So you have this object here, and you have one thread. One thread stores the value of this. That's step one.
Okay.
And this is A. And then step two is another thread reads it out and holds it in a temporary variable, right? And then the first thread stores another object in there, B. Now this guy is going to try yet another object. C is stored in here. But so we just, when we wrote B in here, we invalidated it no longer references A, right? So now A gets garbage collected. It gets garbage collected or explicitly freed. And say we don't have a garbage collector, so we explicitly free A and then we store B in there, right? And now C had read the value of A, or the other thread had read the value of A and wants to store this new object that it just created in there. Well, remember, A got freed, so now you allocate C. It could go in that same spot and have the same exact address, and when it, you know, when you want to store it in here, it may turn out to be, you know, all the same. Right. So it's kind of a mess. In a garbage collected environment, this goes away because you never,
you know, A would never get collected as long as that thread had a reference to it that it could compare with, you know, the value of that memory location. And so the problem disappears. You do have to deal with some other things like, you know, optimizing for good garbage collection performance and things like that. But it turns out that lock-free data structures are much, you know, much easier and often more performant in managed code. So that helps us. Now, on the native side of things, we have another queue. It turns out there's a hosting API for queuing things natively, which ASP.NET uses. And so we have a queue there. That is not a lock-free queue. That's got a lock around it. It's been optimized a little bit in this release. But again, it's native code. It's subject to this problem, and it makes it very, very difficult to optimize that. But the other thing that lives in the native code is all of this thread management stuff. And that's there so that it can switch between app domains. Because if you imagine we put it all in managed code, well, it'd live in some app domain then. And you could instantiate that per app domain, but communicating between them would be at least very slow and, you know, possibly not even possible. And so that stuff lives in native code. And is, you know, part of the core of the
virtual
data
machine.
Yeah.
Excellent. Wow. It's always good to know. Because people still write native code. C or C++, you know, you name it. And certainly the CLR is written in C and C++, right? It's a kernel for all intents and purposes. So yeah, that's kind of nice to know.
App domain provides good isolation. Many applications use that, like ASP.NET and
sure.
SQL Server.
Yeah.
Many important partners do.
Absolutely. SQL Server is an interesting partner because they don't even use threads. They use fibers, but of course they're not really, they don't do anything like that in managed code. That's all. It's way too low level in their engine. But they do a lot. They are doing more with managed code. So how is it working with that team? Because they're like perf junkies.
They are.
I mean, in a good way. I mean, they're brilliant. I mean, was that fun? Or get a lot of feedback from them?
Yes, we get a lot of like you say, they're perf junkies, so it's very challenging to, first of all, to understand what they need and how they are, like you say, turning to use this kind of approaches.
Sure.
But yeah, we get feedback. Sometimes unexpected bugs or requests. That, oh, this is something strange going on here. What do we do?
Excellent. That's awesome. Well, I mean, internal partners. Hey, it's been great meeting you guys and putting some faces behind the thread pool. Excellent. Great job. I mean, this is so impressive compared to where we were in V1 and you know, even V2. I'm looking forward to see people play around with these algorithms,
yes.
See if they can
provide
feedback for you.
Yes.
All right. Right on. Well, hey, good luck, and thank you very much.
Thank
great
you.
Job.
Thanks.